I feel a little tug of nostalgia this morning. All my life, I've been writing four numbers that start with 19 on thousands of letters over the years, on documents requesting the date of my birth, and on checks. Only the last two numbers changing to mark the milestones. 1960, when I came to Wichita in the dual roles of university professor and Christian minister, the decade of the 70s at Plymouth Congregational Church in Wichita State, the 80s when this church was born, and the 90s in which it flourished to surpass all our dreams and gave my wife and me and many of you the happiest church life we have ever known. Now I'm speaking for the first time in a new century and what is popularly accepted as a new millennium, dating the letters and checks with a strange new set of numbers. It's all totally artificial, of course, this whole business of slicing time into segments. But when a few of us were talking about it the other day and someone asked whether I had an all-time favorite theme in the pulpit, I said yes and decided that topic would be my sentimental farewell to the 20th century. It will come as no surprise to those of you who have endured my efforts for a while that I return over and over to this passionate conviction that we cheat ourselves terribly if we cheat the present moment, that for as long as we can possibly manage it, we should salute every single morning with these words, "Behold, this is the day which the Lord has given. I shall rejoice in it and be glad." It may sound simplistic, this theme song, that today is the day, but it's amazing how many people waste precious time yearning for a yesterday that in selective memory we often make better than it was, or imagining a tomorrow that will finally fulfill all our hopes, only to end up by losing the only time we really have, which is right now. Not making the most of the moment because it seems so ordinary in comparison with memories and dreams. Not hearing the music it makes because our ears are cocked for far-off melodies more exotic than the ones playing at the moment. Not living so much as hoping to live until one day it is too late to retrieve what we have lost. Believing this profoundly, I have kept an old Sanskrit proverb before my eyes for years. Yesterday, it says, is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. I know how easily this day may seem quite ordinary unless someone who has never enjoyed the routine blessings we take for granted wakes us up. Someone like Helen Keller, deprived of a priceless gift, who said, "I who am blind can give one hint to those who can see, one admonition to those who would make full use of the gift of sight. Use your eyes as if tomorrow you would be stricken blind." And the same for the other senses. Hear the music of voices, the song of birds, the strains of an orchestra, as if you would be stricken deaf tomorrow. Smell the perfume of flowers. Taste with relish each morsel, as if tomorrow you could never smell and taste again. One more time now, in God's grace, I get to share this favorite message in my own words and in the wise words of others, like those of a man who lived to be an amazing 105 years old, still hale and hearty and with a light in his eyes, when he was asked how he had stayed young so long, did not make the usual answer about good food, hard work, and no bad habits. He preached my favorite message. Every morning when I get up, he said, I go over to the window. Then I say to myself, whether it's raining or snowing or sunny, this is exactly the kind of day I wanted. No precious moments lost complaining because it's raining or too hot or too cold. A man who had learned to live joyously in the moment, to be alive and grateful for every day of his life. I spoke once with a man whose only child had died in a swimming accident. He said, you know, we were always talking, my wife and I, and my daughter, about her future, what she would look like, where we would send her to school, a million and one things, and now there is only a past. In his eyes, I saw the pain of having been so busy anticipating tomorrow that he had let God's great gift of the present slip away unsung. And since of all living Americans who write sermons, my favorite is a New England theologian named Frederick Buechner, I invite you to hear his eloquent way of saying the same thing. Today, this day, any day, he says, is a moment of light, surrounded on all sides by darkness and oblivion. In the entire history of the universe, let alone in your own history, there has never been another just like it, and there will never be another just like it again. It is the point to which all your yesterdays have been leading since the hour of your birth. It is the point from which all your tomorrows will proceed until the hour of your death. If you were aware of how precious it is, you could hardly live through it. Unless you are aware of how precious it is, you can hardly be said to be living at all. If you waste it, it is your life you are wasting. If you look the other way, it may be the moment you have been waiting for always that you are missing. All other days have either disappeared into darkness and oblivion or not yet emerged from it. Today is the only day there is. My children heard this song often while they were growing up, and when one of them got interested in creative writing as a teenager, I began to play a game with him. I would pick something as ordinary as a shoe, a chimney on the house across the street, the color red, the sound of a siren, and ask him to write about it, to make it come alive, to realize it. We would critique together what he had done, and I saw a welcome spark now and then, but I could not have imagined that years later, he would have learned to celebrate daily life in words as powerful as these. Do not look past the richness of so-called ordinary moments in search of happiness on some distant shore. Put your oar in the water of this day. Look after this hour and ask yourself what it means and to whom it's important. The days given to us are few, and they race away like low clouds pushed by a storm. The moments we have are brief. The bright morning of innocence gives way to the hard work of midday, then to the pensiveness of late afternoon, then to the lengthening shadows of evening. The kingdom of heaven is within us and about us, but we can see it only with the eyes of the heart. When we walk into it for one instant, one luminescent moment, we have a working definition of eternity. The last word reminds me what a shame it is that in the religion of so many of us, the words eternal life have to do only with time and not with essence, with quantity or duration of life, rather than quality of life. Jesus seems to me to have known better. Instead of restricting eternal life to something that might come after death, he met people who, he said, possessed it at that very moment. Sermons I heard as a boy stressed how we might have it by and by if we were properly baptized and came faithfully to church and never missed communion, but no one ever said what I think would have thrilled me to the depths, that right now, in this very moment, we can enjoy a kind of life so deeply in touch with eternal values like love, understanding, and compassion that it can be described as eternal life. But this was not part of our creed, so most of us were willing to wait patiently and often stoically for the gift after death of a quality of life called eternal, when our faces might have been radiant with happiness to know that we can have it now. That we can have it by the simple expedient of realizing that no day is common, that we are knee-deep in miracles if we have eyes to see, that the quiet music of an ordinary day is a symphony if we have ears to hear. There were a couple of English poets, once good friends, named William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who decided to publish a book of their poetry in 1798. They wrote a preface in which one of them, Wordsworth, said his part of their venture was to wake people up to the glory of the commonplace. He reminded his readers that familiarity really does often breed contempt, that what we see every day tends to get a film over it, so that what is beautiful in it is ignored. And he said he wished to write about such things in a way that would cause people to see them again as if for the first time. So instead of celebrating wars and kings and famous monuments, he wrote about rocks and hills and trees and lakes and farm life and walks on country roads and morning sun and evening rain. Poetry has not been the same since. And at least one man, one of the most brilliant men who ever lived, John Stuart Mill, who had lost interest in everything and become profoundly depressed, said that when he read that poetry and saw the everyday world with fresh eyes, it literally saved his life. I'm not so foolish as to think we can feel that degree of intensity all the time, but somewhere between that level of awareness and our usual oblivion, there has to be a middle ground that turns life into a sacrament. Many years before I came to Wichita, I met a man in St. Louis who profoundly influenced my life. His name, may he rest in peace, was Paul Logue, a vice president for Monsanto, who had found a way to make daily life sacramental. Every morning, soon after he woke up, he went into a small room, no bigger than a walk-in closet, which he had set aside as a place for meditation. And there he knelt to thank God for the gift of another day. You must not imagine him as some sentimental wimp, afraid to face the day without help. This was a tall, immensely dignified man with a strength of purpose that absolutely dominated a room, but he stopped each morning in that little closet and knelt without a hint of embarrassment to ask help in using the priceless and irretrievable new day wisely. Then he had his breakfast and went downtown to work. He told me once, as we sat at his dining room table, that a poet, whose name he had forgotten, taught him about the miracle of an ordinary day. "I have walked them through," the poet said, "and found the quick surprises of their hours, something lovely and unexpected to do. I tread them softly. They are hallowed ground. There are no common days." But this is always hard for us to understand. We want to set special days apart from the faded denim of ordinary days. And so even as our own Christian faith began to be institutionalized, people wanted Sunday more sacred than Monday. The 25th day of December held holier than the 26th, and Easter so special that people who skipped worship all year were careful to show up on that day. No great harm done, perhaps, so long as we remember that the essence of religion is what one does with the great majority of ordinary days. It seems to me such a foolish thing to marvel at miracles that are 2,000 years old and miss the ones that happen on the most normal of days. When a baby takes its first step, when a man looks over his newspaper and speaks the quiet assurance of his love, when a brave woman smiles through pain and fear in a hospital and says she feels quite well, thank you, and she's glad you dropped by. Wonders so familiar, we take them for granted. We go on spinning our tales of a heaven far off and stumble blindly through the only one we can be absolutely sure of. So, yes, this is my favorite of all sermon topics. This idea that every day is special, hallowed by its own fragile, never-to-be-repeated magic. Many years ago, I found this truth so hauntingly expressed that I framed it and hung it on a wall to remind myself of what is so easy to forget. And I hope you listen to the words with special care and remember them. Normal day. Let me be aware of the treasure you are. Let me learn from you, love you, savor you, bless you before you depart. Let me not pass you by in quest of some rare and perfect tomorrow. Let me hold you while I may, for it will not always be so. One day I shall dig my fingers into the earth, or bury my face in the pillow, or stretch myself taut, or raise my hands to the sky and want more than all the world your return. There are, you know, gospel truths not written in the gospels, and this is one of them. This word about how many normal, ordinary days pass uncherished simply because they are there one after the other, always underfoot, until one day, they are not normal. There's the long and happy love that seems so safe, all but overlooked in the routine of daily business, and then something happens. The sun falls from the sky, and you sit in the darkness, remembering the comfort of all those ordinary days. Some months ago, I found my credo poignantly expressed once again in a popular little book I know some of you have read called Tuesdays with Maury. A friend and former student, Mitch, asks Maury shortly before his death what he would do if he had one single day of good health again. "Let's see," says Maury. "I'd get up in the morning, do my exercises, have a lovely breakfast of sweet rolls and tea, go for a swim, then have my friends come over for a nice lunch. I'd have them come one or two at a time so we could talk about their families, their issues, talk about how much we mean to each other. Then I'd like to go for a walk in a garden with some trees, watch their colors, watch the birds, take in the nature that I haven't seen in so long now." When he finishes, Mitch asks, "If that's all, if that's it." And Maury says, "That's it." It was so simple, his ex-student and old friend marvels, so average, I was actually a little disappointed. I figured he'd fly to Italy, or have lunch with the president, or romp on the seashore, or try every exotic thing he could think of. After all these months, lying there unable to move a leg or a foot, how could he find perfection in such an average day? Then I realized this was the whole point. Do we?